This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us. We're going to talk about cities today, the problems they're facing, and what needs to be done to make them more sustainable. Our guest is Edna Ellie Ledesma. She is an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture and the director of the Kaufman Lab for the Study and Design of Food Systems and Marketplaces. Is your city ready for the future? What does a city need to be sustainable? Give us a call. Join in 800-642-1234, or you can send an email. The address is ideas@wpr.org. Edna, thank you so much for being with us today.
Good morning, and thank you so much for the invitation.
You bet. It's always very interesting to think about what the cities of the future are going to look like. Of course, we're not going to talk about flying cars or anything like that, but a thing that's going to make sense, right? But first, is the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture relatively new? Did they just combine some things?
Yes, it is relatively new, I guess you could say, from sort of the perspective of the university's history.
Right.
But sort of the context is when the university went through a number of restructurings about 15 years ago, there were departments that began to be consolidated. And the Department of Landscape Architecture and the Department of Planning were consolidated 5.5 years ago. And I was actually the first hire within my department post-merger. And so part of that reasoning is that, you know, we are experts within the built environment that can think about problems from a policy and a design perspective. And given my training, I was able to kind of tap into both sides of the department and introduce a more sort of holistic way of approaching how we educate our future architects and planners in our society.
Okay, well, it makes total sense. You're talking about your background. Why don't you give us a little idea about your professional background?
Yes. So I grew up in a household where my father is a contractor and my mother is she was a stay-at-home mom. She actually trained as a pharmacist, but stayed at home after we were born and really became a community advocate. And so, you know, growing up around construction sites, I wanted to grow up and be an architect and, you know, design beautiful buildings. So I went to school to become an architect, but as I matriculated through my education, I realized that I started to care more about people and communities than I did about the buildings. I think the buildings are really important, but sort of my education led me in a path that introduced concepts of more kind of cityness and civicness. And I studied urban design. I got a master's of architecture. I studied urban design as well in my master's. And then eventually that led me to a path of research, and my PhD is in urban planning. It's in urban and regional sciences. So it kind of my perspective of the world kind of grew and grew and grew, because I think, you know, the more we think about these problems, you really have to think sort of wide about how we approach our cities. And, you know, it began by thinking about, you know, beautiful construction details, and now I think about city infrastructure. And it's all very related, but you've got to be able to kind of switch your brain back and forth.
And cities haven't really thought about it that way in the past, have they? It's kind of like, let's do this little thing here and let's do this little thing over there. And that's led to some problems, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And I think one of the challenges that we've seen is, you know, and at least, you know, we are living in the 21st century, you know, very much in the 21st century now. It's no longer the beginning, you know, it's 23 years in. But we're definitely living with the problems of our past. You know, so much of our cities that, at least in the North American context and many of developed societies, we're living in cities that were predominantly built in the 20th century. And the 20th century was a time when we really began to isolate professions. You know, before it used to be that, you know, the architect could do a lot of things. The architect sort of could do urban plans. But then, you know, when we began to think of professions in a very different context, particularly in the 21st century, we isolated these notions of who was the engineer, who was the architect, who's the landscape architecture. We saw the birth of landscape architecture. We saw the birth of planning. And so that isolation of our thinking capacity within cities and society has led to many problems. And we also saw, you know, in the 21st century that we began to build, you know, from a capitalist perspective, we began to build in cities that were really auto-dominated, that were really about militarizing our cities. That's how highways were introduced. And so we weren't putting at the core, our values were more about, you know, economic growth and less about thinking about how to preserve our environment. And we began to see a shift in that thinking in the introduction of sort of the notion of sustainability when our society began to fracture towards the end of the 20th century. And, you know, I tell my students, we're living in a wonderful time. It's a very complicated time, but it's a great time to be a planner, to be an architect, to be a landscape architect, because we have an opportunity at, you know, we have so many problems to fix today.
Well, let's talk about some of those problems. What are like your top five things that really need to be focused on? Because there's lots of problems.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think when we think about cities, we have to think about sort of human fundamental needs, right? I think of myself as a pluralist from a planning perspective. You know, I focus on public space. I focus on sort of the public realm in my research. But there are planners that are specifically focused on issues of housing or specifically focused on issues of transportation. And I like to think about all of those sort of in micro connections. You know, fundamentally, we want to make sure that within our society, we have the ability to house all of our community members. And that is a huge problem. You know, we have seen the rise of homelessness and the rise, increasing rise of cost of living to be able to afford to buy or rent a house. You know, like the fact that people have to put in more than half of their income to be able to, you know, be able to be housed. That's a problem. That's one problem. Another problem is the issue of, you know, fractured infrastructure. You know, our highways, you know, the Federal Highway Act that came in, you know, in the mid 20th century, we saw a boom of the highway systems coming in the 1960s, 70s. And so now this is infrastructure that is decaying. It's, you know, 50, 60 years old. And we need to, you know, think strategically about what it is that we're going to do to be able to stay connected, to move our goods and services, but also address the fact that we created concrete jungles that separated communities through redlining. You know, specifically within my research, you know, I study marketplaces. And one of the things that, you know, we are just, you know, kicking off is we're part of a large initiative through USDA to address climate smart and climate smart methods to developing and producing our food. You know, how are we going to be able to address, you know, the increasing greenhouse gas problems and increasing, like you said, you know, increasing storms, fires, these things that used to be a 100-year event are happening every 5-10 years. And agricultural practices can be one way of addressing those challenges. So, you know, there's a multiplicity of ways of kind of slicing the pie. We can think about gentrification, right? Like displaced businesses. You know, that all connects to, you know, our global challenges of economic polarization, right? We're, you know, we've lost and we've sort of pulled away at the middle class. And that has to do with, you know, having an opportunity to, you know, to say start a business. But how can someone start a business when, you know, prices of a downtown storefront to rent a storefront is just, you know, out of control.
So
there's many little pieces to this puzzle.
Go right ahead. I'm going to add some more.
Go ahead.
You're right. I mean, there are so many pieces. It's really daunting to even think about it. But if there's someone out there right now who's listening, who's in a municipality, they know they have these problems, but where do they start? What do they come and talk to you? I mean, where do they go?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm another component of my work is I sit on the national board of the American Planning Association. And the American Planning Association is the national organization, national institute that connects professional planners. And we talk about these issues in many ways from a sort of a top approach. And we think about, you know, what can we do at the national level? But what we say, you know, a lot of these problems really need to be addressed at the local level. You know, what can a local municipality do to make incremental shifts in their day-to-day practice to ensure that their communities are making a stride towards equity, because that fundamentally, that's what we're here to achieve. You know, as planners, our role is to be able to balance the needs of a community. There are many times they're conflicting, but we need to be able to come to terms and say, what is it that we need to be able to survive and be able to coexist? Because that's fundamentally what cities are. You know, we come together to be able to make it work together. And so a small municipality has to think about, you know, how are we going to be able to, you know, increase or maintain our jobs, support our school systems, house our residents. And at the same time, you know, one way is, you know, how do we bring money in? And a lot of that happens through tourism, bringing money from the outside in. And so what... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go right ahead.
I was just saying, like, think about if you are a mayor of a small town, what are small policy changes you could do to be able to address all those things I said? You know, what incentives could you provide to your local businesses so that it's a business that's owned by a local resident or a minority-owned resident? What incentives could you provide a contractor to ensure that they're actually using sustainable practices, decreasing the use of, you know, parking restrictions? We don't need to be driving all the time. You know, things like that they seem minimal but could have a long-term effect on your community's impact on the big global picture.
So basically take a small part one at a time, mm-hmm. but have a plan. I'm assuming you need to kind of know where you're going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, and that is what planning is. And one of the things we do as planners is plan for the future. But now the future is incredibly and increasingly uncertain. And so how do you plan for change? And that the reality is, you have to plan for the ability to constantly adapt. You know, we used to have these kind of 10-year, 20-year plans and assume that we were going to get to that 20-year benchmark. Well, no, that now a city needs to be able to do that 10-year, you know, visioning comprehensive plan and assume that it's got to be revisited every few years to say what changed. You know, we just went through an incredibly shock, the COVID pandemic. You know, none of us really assume that this, what we're doing now, you know, talking over Zoom, over these virtual connectors was going to be our norm. But these kinds of opportunities for us to have the ability to connect through technology have marginalized so many other people that don't have access to technology. So we have to be able to kind of take a step back and assess, is what we're doing a positive change? And if it is, great, let's keep adapting. But we also have to think about who's being left out of the conversation.
And what are the practical implications of having a city that's equitable? You know, because there are people who are designing things or who are looking at the bottom line, it's like, why should I do this?
Well, I think that's a really great question. And part of it is, you know, what a community looks for is sustainability from an economic perspective many times. And we've seen through the research that, you know, supporting, you know, minority-owned businesses, supporting women-owned businesses can actually be, you know, can have a trickle-down effect and an impact across the community. If you invest in, you know, in sustainable building practices, the long-term effect of that, you know, is actually thinking about the benefits to not spending as much on the, you know, the type of energy sources that are not renewable. And also, you know, think about investing now in the technology. Say if you're building a new building and you want to put photovoltaic panels or some kind of, green roof. Some of these things are feasible in certain contexts and some are not. But, you know, if you're in a place where wind is actually a benefit to you, you know, could you actually consider, you know, installing that kind of technology, investing in that now, because the long-term economic impact is going to be great for the community. And so, you know, the main thing that I would tell communities is, you know, a lot of times we think of the bottom line in right now, but you want to think of the bottom line is important for, you know, what will happen in 5, 10, 15, 20, and even 50 years. And I think a lot of these practices can have that return on investment.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. We have been talking with Edna Ellie Ledesma. She is an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture and the director of the Kaufman Lab for the Study and Design of Food Systems and Marketplaces. What questions do you have about the future of cities? What don't you like about the city you're living in? Join in. We want to talk to you too. 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wrpr.org. I'm Jill Nadeau in for Larry Mueller. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Claire Neipert is our on-air producer today, and A. Emily Ralph is our technical director. After 11:45, stick around. We're going to talk to the author of a fun new book on Midwestern conversation. But right now, we're going to be talking about cities. In some of the things I've read that you've presented or you've done talks, you've talked about social infrastructure. Could you talk a little bit about what that means?
Absolutely. So, I mentioned earlier that one of the reasons that fundamental core reasons why we exist as a society in cities is to coexist, right? To be able to share resources, to be able to, do less together to have a greater impact. At the core of civicness, in many of these kind of historic earlier societies was always, the agora, the historic notion of a place for gathering, a place for democratic connection. And those social connections a lot of times happen in modern society and in those times as well, they happen in public spaces. And the public spaces that I study are markets. And so, we want to make sure that when we're thinking about societies and cities and in small towns, it doesn't matter the scale, think about, what place do I go to where I'm not forced to spend money? I might have the ability to do so, but I have the ability to simply connect to somebody else. One of the things that I really, really was hesitant to give in to this was during the pandemic, obviously we were all thinking about, public health protocols and, we had to, socially distance and be able to protect ourselves. And I'm grateful and I'm very privileged to have been able to work from home. I'm not, immunocompromised, I could take certain risks. But one of the things we began doing is, shopping online for our groceries at stores. And that just completely shattered my heart, my urbanist heart. And part of that is because, one of my theories around socialization is that, when we go to, Whole Foods or, Trader Joe's or, the Willie Street Co-op, we have the ability to go into a place and bump into grandma and have a very quick interaction that might potentially change your perspective on something. And that is so important to how we exist as a society. You have to force yourself to go out into a public domain to interact with someone that thinks and is maybe different from you. And when we, during the pandemic, we were forced to isolate, we lost those touch points, the ability to actually see that there are other people in this world that are different. And maybe I need to be thinking about what their needs are relative to what I need in this place. And so what we see today is so much conflict. And I attribute so much of that is because we don't force ourselves to interact with people that are different. It's healthy to have conversations with people that are of different political, religious, ethnic, social backgrounds, right? Because I want to be able to empathize with their point of view. And that's what cities are supposed to be able to provide in farmers markets, your local flea, swap meet, at the grocery store, in parks. Those are the places where we have those touch points. And I hope that as we're coming out of that pandemic era, that we're able to reconnect to those connections because they're so important for us to be able to be in a healthy society, socially, culturally, as a community.
And that makes total sense because it's really difficult to hate someone that you know, right?
Exactly.
You may disagree with them, but it's hard to hate them. Let's go to the phones. We have Annalisa in Green Bay with a question. Hi, Annalisa.
Hi. I, first of all, I, I totally agree with the previous comments. But my question is, what do you see as a role of public transportation in the future? I mean, these enormous parking lots are really nothing but an eyesore, if you ask me. That was my question.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I like to think about public transport, and I hope people can see that public transportation is a utility that is not meant to be for profit. You know, public transportation needs to just survive. And so the way it survives is by users actually taking advantage of that and supporting public transit. You know, we need public transit, or we need transportation, whether it's public or private, to be able to offer choices. And one of the things that, you know, we need to be able to provide in our communities is the ability to say, I have chosen to not own a car. And therefore, a city has the option for me to be able to take a bus, take a metro, take a taxi, ride a bike, ride a scooter, have safe sidewalks so I can actually get to and from places, right? So we need to think about transportation holistically as an array of choices. When you get to a place where a city doesn't have the ability to provide choices, then people are forced to figure it out on their own. And that's where we see, you know, increased car ownership. And that also becomes an issue of inequity. The issue with parking lot, that's a great question. And, you know, planning is really fundamentally the system to blame for a lot of these rules that in the 1970s, 1960s were instituted, and in the 90s, you know, like it just sort of kept perpetuating that there are parking restrictions that dictate, say, for example, when the shopping mall was built in the 1970s, a parking restriction would say for every square foot of area that is used for commercial or residential or whatever the land use might be, you're required to have X number of parking spots. So then we get these massive, you know, concrete islands that are not being used and that are contributing to our, you know, the urban heat island effect, the lack of green infrastructure in our cities, the increased stormwater runoff that isn't being collected, right? And you go on and on and on. It just becomes this perpetuating problem. So, you know, the need to actually think about how to adapt those spaces is one issue. From a public utility side, we want to make sure that we're supporting our public transit to be able to give people choices. And so, you know, it might be thinking about rerouting things every few years to be able to, that you're always capturing the right pool of communities to take them from point A to point B. You know, I can give you a quick little anecdote. You know, I had a car when I needed it when I was a student because I had to commute. And then I moved to Wisconsin 5 years ago and I got rid of it. I was terrified of the snow, but also I had the ability to live downtown. And I said, I don't need a car. Well, I just had a baby 5 months ago and we had to get a car because in society we live in, you know, a car is a utility to move a tiny human around and to do all these other things. But I see cars as a utility. It shouldn't be a luxury. You know, it's a thing that can get you from point A to point B. But if I didn't have that choice, I hope that my city, my community, would be able to provide me a choice to get to the places I need to be.
Those darn babies, they just are inconvenient sometimes, aren't they?
I'll tell them one day, because of you, I had to get a car.
Yes. Something to hold over them. Thank you, Annalisa. That was a great, great call. Thank you very much. So you talked about green architecture. What is it?
So we think about green architecture. It's actually it's an interesting idea, and I think also in many earlier you made a joke about sort of the futurists like thinking about flying cars, and you know I think architecture kind of also has gone through a wave of that extreme notion of thinking about green architecture, and I was seeing some postings recently about AI and how AI is being used to think about like the intersection of like the environment, green and architecture, and like kind of thinking about sort of the living building. And I want to think about that more from that perspective, like the living building. So, you know, a building is something that needs to be adaptable. You know, we want to think about everything that we build has a lifespan. So unfortunately, a lot of the housing stock in our cities was built in the, you know, at the sort of pre-war and then sort of mid-century in the 20th century. And that was built, you know, sort of timber frame construction. A lot of that has an expiration date. So unfortunately, buildings have expiration dates based on how they're built. And the way that you design the building can also have sort of pigeonhole them into a certain use. So, you know, the way that I see the future of our buildings is we want to think about them to be able to be adaptable. We want them to be living environments. So think about how they bring in air in and out of the building, how they connect to utilities. Is there a way of actually having the building measure how much energy you're being actually consuming in that space? Is there a way of including, you know, solar panels or, you know, like I mentioned earlier, having a green roof, something that actually has a direct impact on the carbon footprint of that environment with our society. So a lot of us, you know, can we think about our home and what simple changes could I do to my home to have a greater impact on or less of an impact on the environment? Is it about the kind of parking space that I have? Is it about how many trees I have in my backyard? The kind of energy consumption how much can you push your boundaries of thermal comfort, right, to be able to change how much we consume. And so if we think about, for example, a parking lot, you know, a parking lot today, a parking ramp, this is a concrete beast. And that concrete beast, you know, could we think of a parking lot that in 10, 15 years, when in, you know, in my Edna's world, you know, we're reduced, we reduced parking restrictions so that we no longer need that much parking and people are, you know, are using public transit or whatever other options there are, that we can actually change those parking lots, adapt them to be something else. Right, the idea that it's adaptable, that our buildings could be adaptable for something else. Even today, you know, we, you know, who thought that our home would be our office? You know, so many of us have the ability to work from home. And is that, you know, can we reconceive of the spaces we construct in a way that has the ability to adapt? That's the key thing to, I think, if anything that can we take away from today's talk is, we got to be able to adapt to the changes. And a lot of that has to do with the way we build things. If we don't do it right, if we don't build it right for that potential transition, then, you know, we kind of face more problems.
Mm-hmm. And we've got Christina from Glenwood with a question that's kind of related to that. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm wondering what you think about the future of the malls and what to do with the many who have closed. And then in addition, I'm also wondering, have you got a book that addresses future planning for our homes?
Oh, that's a great question. So the question of the, well, the two-part question, the mall question. So yes, I mean, I think that there is a trend in that has been happening for the last, I would say, 10, 15 years, you know, and you've probably seen this in your community that, you know, the mall, the indoor shopping environment has shifted with society's, you know, desires to be more in outdoor spaces. So we always have outdoor shopping centers. That is more pleasing to communities now where it's interesting because we sort of, everything is sort of on a pendulum. You know, everything used to be in the downtown, which was outdoor and you had these smaller stores and this interesting sort of incremental shift of options. And then the trend was, let's all start driving to the suburbs. So we need shopping centers and everything was sort of cookie cutter. And then we kind of come back to this idea of the outdoor shopping center. But what do we do? And there's a lot of examples out there of what cities have done to be able to adapt. I'll give you a couple of examples. I was in Texas before moving to Wisconsin, so I have a lot of examples from Texas. In Austin, the Highland Mall, which is one of the city's kind of shopping malls from back in the 70s, they actually, the city and the community college partnered, and they turned that into a satellite campus for the local community college. So thinking about these sort of larger spaces that could then become, you know, classrooms and meeting spaces. And at the same time, there's this interesting notion of publicness inside of the mall, which could be, you know, social spaces for students, right? I've seen in places where the malls are actually beginning to infill the parking lots and adding more options outside of the mall so that they're kind of bringing a second life to the mall. I've seen Walmarts that are being converted, right? There's very cheap construction of sort of tilt-up construction of these big shopping areas like a Walmart. There's a Walmart in South Texas in the city of McAllen that was converted into a public library. So, you know, there is so much that could be lost and that we can impact our environment by demolishing buildings. So the more we can preserve and adapt, the greater impact we have on not impacting the environment, I guess you could say the inverse way. But yeah, malls are a great opportunity because you've got an envelope, lots of space. How can we reconceive of that as a place that can have options through education, community resources? And in terms of a book, that's a good question. I can't think of anything. I don't personally have a book. That's a great future project. I'm working on a book currently on something similar. It's on insurgent urbanism. So thinking about community-driven options for modifying and adapting our planning and design strategies. And it's more of a global perspective. It's an edited volume. And it'll come out next May. I'm happy to share that info when it comes out. It comes out next May through Routledge. But others, I mean, there's plenty of things to read. I will say that, you know, the godmother of planning is Jane Jacobs. I would encourage you to read Jane Jacobs' books. The Death and Life of Great American City is a wonderful one that talks about the value of community and sort of the tension between top-down planning and local planning. So that's, to me, that's a good one to go to.
And what was the name of that again? Because I know people are going to call.
Jane Jacobs, Death and Life of Great American Cities.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And thank you for that question, Christina. That's a really good point. I saw it was a joke on Facebook for Gen Xers. Those malls would be a great place for retirement community since that's where we grew up, right? I love that. So these are wonderful ideas and they make total sense, but where's the money going to come from for this?
Right. So one of the things that we need is public-private partnerships, right? We need to be able to come back to that notion of what is the bottom line? What can a city do to be able to provide those resources? Cities have limited resources because they've got to pay for that public transit. They've got to keep our social services up and running. So, you know, one thing city has many times is land, right? So can we think strategically about how we see land as an opportunity? And maybe, you know, some places we see the ability to do what are called 100-year or 99-year lease, where the city will actually rent the land to a private developer who sees the ability to make a return on investment. But the hook is the city can say, here are some caveats. When you do this, when you put in this mixed-use building, you've got to be able to provide, you know, a certain percentage of affordable housing. You've got to be able to say, you know, at the lower levels, storefronts, certain percentage has to go to a locally owned business. You know, things like that. You know, how can a city preserve power through codes, through partnerships, through these connections to be able to say, okay, we need your money. You're going to make the profits, but here are ways that I can make sure that our values are going to be executed.
And I believe you're doing or have done something in Milwaukee near the Fondy food market or farmers market. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and where that is right now?
Yeah, so we one of the things we do within the planning program is every cohort of students and then the landscape architecture program, you know, we are training students that are going to be professionals. They're professional degrees that are accredited through their various accreditation boards. And so we are required to make sure that students have real hands-on experience with an actual, what I call a live project. So during the pandemic, we partnered with the Fondy Food Center and the City of Milwaukee's planning department to help them address the address what was happening at the time. They were doing a comprehensive plan update for the Fond du Lac and North area. It was actually the first planning document that came out of the city of Milwaukee in the 1990s. So it was the first one that was getting an update. And so it's a neighborhood that is at the core is the Fondy Market, but you think about a market as a place of connection. So from the market, you have a neighborhood of predominantly low-income African-American, very close to the downtown, but sort of full of opportunity. But how do we protect and support the neighborhood with the fear of gentrification? So our students were able to come and visit the market and think about the market as an anchor for that development. So they developed 5 different plans that were then sent to the city, presented to the community, and with those plans, and with the effort of supporting an ongoing planning process. So, you know, as I mentioned, these kind of public-private partnerships are so important. If you're a local community and you're thinking, you know, we've got a lot of things to think about updating, but we need ideas, go to your local community college, come to UW and connect with us, because our students are a great resource to think of those ideas. And we're cheap, right? We're students. And our students have an opportunity to work with, you know, actual real life problems. So that's another way of thinking about partnerships.
Yeah, that's a wonderful opportunity. So tell us, is that pretty much what the Kaufman Lab is all about? Or what are some of the other things that you're doing there?
Yeah, so it's a little bit different. The Kaufman Lab, we apply a citizen science approach to our research. One of the key components of what we do is we run a program called Farm to Facts. And I like to call that generally like a farmer's market census. So we work with market managers and market organizations across the country to provide them with the tools and train them with the tools that they need to be able to provide a holistic picture of their market. The surveys that they conduct throughout the year on an incremental basis are able to show their economic, social, and environmental impact of their market, of their vendors, and of the constituents, you know, the different customers that come to their market. Why? Because markets many times are, you know, strapped for resources. They're, you know, constantly knocking at city council's door or the local charities for support. And so the data that comes out of our work is something that they can demonstrate and say, hey, look, we are actually bringing in X number of, you know, double dollars through our program, or bringing in that, you know, supporting this many people from this zip code, which is an underserved zip code. Or, you know, we have X number of vendors that are Hmong vendors. And like, you know, how do you show that picture? And a lot of times, you know, we think we know until we actually collect the data. So that's the work that we do.
Very true. Having been a farmer's market manager at one time in my past, yeah. I understand that completely. And just Stella had called in and she had a suggestion for a book. It's called A Pattern Language Towns, Buildings, Construction. And it's from the Center for Environmental Structure Series. So she said that's a very good book also to look at.
And I wonder if it's the same as Christopher Alexander, A Pattern Language.
I don't know.
But so look up Christopher Alexander and that'll come up.
That's another one? Yeah. Okay, wonderful. Oh, it is. Apparently Clara just said it is. So okay. Perfect. Thank you, Clara. Thank you so much for being with us, Edna. We really appreciate that. And we'd love to have you back when your book comes out so we can talk about the subject again. Very important. So thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you for the time.
We have been talking with Edna Ellie Ledesma. She is an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture and the director of the Kaufman Lab for the Study and Design of Food Systems and Marketplaces. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back to talk about Midwestern conversation.